is Iconic, with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th age. I'm your host JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hey. Hello.
We have a great show for you this week. In that iconic look, we are talking about encounter creation, specifically as it relates to 13th age. So let's head into that iconic look.
That iconic look.
All right, so in a lot of ways, encounters are the basic building blocks of a role-playing game session and story. So Nick, why don't you kind of walk us through, what is an encounter? What is it made of?
An encounter is a segment of a session. So you go sit down at the table, you get online, you're going to play whatever, and you go through a couple of scenes. Each one of those scenes is an encounter. D&D phrases it really well in that there's three pillars to a good adventure or an encounter. There's a social encounter or social aspect of it. There's a discovery aspect of it, and there's a combat aspect of it. And for each, you know, for your encounter, you could focus solely on one of those three if you like, or try to mix it up and do a little bit of each. 13th Age it's very combat heavy because it has its roots in D&D, but there's also a lot of room for role-playing and discovering with the icon mechanics and the backgrounds and all of that as well.
Well, is it that 13th Age is combat heavy, or is it just that the rules that are presented in the book are combat focused?
I would say it's more of the rules that's presented in the book. And honestly, that's going to be stereotypical of pretty much any role-playing game. I haven't been in the role-playing industry for that long, but I haven't seen really any game mechanic that does well on character advancement outside of some form of combat. Yeah. Numenera does a pretty good job with saying that they focus on discovery and exploration, that sort of thing. But again, all of the mechanics surrounding the characters themselves and what you find in the books are all combat focused, or most of them are.
Yeah,
I think most systems do that. They kind of devote more crunchiness to the complicated combat rules of what you want to present. Role playing is really kind of left up to the group and the GM
You
do it, and it is no hard. I've played in games where if you're talking a good talk, there's no dice rolling, and then if you get stuck, like, oh, okay, you know, roll this.
Yeah.
And so it's not a hard fixed, unless it's entirely set up like that and there's no combat. You know, I've played one or two games like that that had no combat, and it was just all rolls to do things that weren't combat related. But yeah, I think some people get the misconception that there's no role playing in this game. Like, all the rules just say you fight. There's other things out there that just haven't put hard, fast rules on it. It's how you develop, so you get your one unique things and all those other things in a character.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The mechanical focus of most games is on the combat side, because it's the side where character life and death hangs.
Well, and honestly, it's where the math is.
Yeah,
it's easy to put it in a rule book, and it makes sense.
Yeah,
what? There's math in this game.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That it's. It's easy to look at a role-playing game, just any role-playing game, and say the majority of the rules are combat-focused. Well, that's true, but again, it's from the math side of things. We should get you into Shadowrun. Then you'll see a very, very, very combat-heavy system.
It's a great game. You should try it.
Yeah.
But there's also a lot of social stuff to it. I mean, a lot of people, they devote a lot of numbers to, yes, I have, the 18 strength and a +5 sword. So what do you say to the guard coming in the gate?
Yeah, I stab him with my sword.
So there's a lot of other things out there in the game.
As written, most of the mechanics surrounding character progression is centered around combat.
Yes. All right, so Mark, what makes for a good encounter from the GM side of the table?
Death.
Okay, I would agree with that.
First you have to come up to your adversaries, and we'll talk about it later, about how you figure out, do I throw a kobold at him or a dragon. So obviously there's a big difference there. The other thing is your environment, you're outdoors, indoors, underground, is it in a town? And kind of the setting mood of what you're trying to present or what the group, it kind of plays into that. There are some groups, maybe not beginners, but more advanced, that like, I'm tired of playing the fighter, and they have more of the social interaction, non-combat skills. So you should try to have some encounters with that, not just, well, I don't care what you do, because then the player gets turned off and leaves your group, and you've lost probably a good asset.
And just for clarification, in this episode, we're going to be focusing most on the combat encounters.
Yeah, I would say the distinction between a scene and an encounter. All encounters are scenes, but not all scenes are encounters. Encounters are really scenes that have a adversarial nature to them.
Sometimes encounters cause scenes when the player dies.
That's true. But you know, a role-playing scene might, in 13th Age, will have background checks, will have one unique things, icon relationships. But when you move into the encounter side of things, it is really when combat hits the table. That's in my mind, a better delineation between scenes and encounters. Because I don't approach when I create scenes. If you guys are talking to somebody, that's not an encounter. An encounter is where I'm building monsters and adversaries and escalation dice stuff, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's easier in that setting to recognize that there's importance to what's being taken place. In a lot of scenes, there's not necessarily a lot of important stuff going on. I mean, there's definitely a helping build the framework for the overall campaign and where you're trying to steer your players, but there isn't the hard and heavy weight to just a typical scene.
At least mechanically.
So, and you also have to think about implications to your story that you're doing. Now, I also kind of throw in there the red herring aspect. If you're always doing breadcrumb, every encounter is going to deal with the story, lead to, you know, finding the red crown of Omadon, and then all of a sudden you have an encounter, has nothing to do with the storyline, and they'll latch onto that, and it'll cause quite a bit of fun with the group trying to figure out why, when we're doing, you know, this, fighting orcs, and this, and all of a sudden demons attacked us. Why are they attacking, you know?
So all of those pieces come together to make an encounter, you know? Mm-hmm. Your adversaries being themed, your environment, implications for the story, but what really makes an encounter interesting? What are your thoughts, Nick?
I think when all of the pieces are working together and they aren't in conflict or contrasting each other too much, I think that's what helps build a good encounter. I think as far as choosing what level of adversaries and the strength of the adversaries, you want them to be a little bit tougher than you, so it's a hard fight. You don't just want to be able to, you know, hit once or twice and then everyone falls over dead. You want it to be fun and engaging in that way. But I think verisimilitude in the midst of all of that is what sells me on it.
What about you, Mark? What when you're planning an encounter for a game, what are some touchstones you look for making the encounter interesting?
Well, you want them – as a GM, you'd hope all your encounters are memorable, but let's be honest, they aren't.
No.
Once in a while, we hit one that's truly memorable that, you know, years later, hey, do you remember when we were fighting that and that – those –
that Minotaur and Gareth's game.
Yes. So that's that you hope for that. I always strive. You talked about that with the descriptions, and I'm probably not the best at doing that, setting the mood and giving it a description of what's there. I do like visual aids. I'm doing that in the game I'm running right now, post-apocalyptic, so I do a lot of pictures. I'll pull them up my laptop and say, this is kind of the environment. You know, that whole picture is worth 1,000 words, and it probably describes it better than I could. But I always appreciated that as a player, too, instead of, you know, just, you know, you're in a cave and a dragon appears. And it's not the same as describing, like you said, the whole atmosphere, maybe a little bit of the darkness, build up the tension, and then something happens. That's hard to accomplish, I think, as a GM. And they get to work on it.
Yeah.
Do you use soundtracks at all?
No, I've tried to before. I kind of got away from trying to collect some. A lot of times I'll play, especially like movie themes. Lord of the Rings are great. There's another one, Midnight. I can't think of the name of it. But
Midnight
I play
Syndicate.
It. Yeah, play it in the background, low in the background to kind of try to set the mood. But but that would be great too if you can get music.
I'm a big fan of using anything Hans Zimmer, Gladiator. There's a lot of really good soundtracks for setting the mood for fights. And then 13th Age has a soundtrack that has a lot of good fight music as well. So one thing that I do to try and pick up on the descriptions that, like you were talking about, Nick and Mark, it is always worth it if you're sitting down and planning your encounter, for me at least, to come up with a bullet list of maybe not read aloud text, not like pre-scripting what I'm going to say, but as you're playing your encounter, come up with at least one touchstone for each sense. You know, something they smell and something they hear and something they see. So you can give a description that is more than just, and you walk into this cave and it's a dragon. Well, why? What else is in the cave? What's going on? And yes, with 13th Age, you can use icon relationship roles to add that chandelier that makes sense to be in the bar fight. But if your players know, hey, there's a, you mentioned the chandelier. Okay, well, now maybe we can, you can get them to be using that for background checks and get, you know stunts and stuff like that.
JM, I really like what you said about making sure that you include the different senses for your characters just as a way of helping them engage in what you're describing. I would say never forget about the sixth sense. But the hair on the back of your neck that's standing up, the cave seemed a little bit too dark. You know, things like that kind of play on the overall perception. Doesn't necessarily tie into one of the five senses, but there's something else in there that's adding to it.
Yeah. Or one of the other things that you can add in to really tie your players to the scene is have a little note card with all of your characters' backgrounds, not numbers, but just the backgrounds and their one unique thing. So maybe, and put at least one or two of your characters' backgrounds into the senses. So for example, we've been coming back to this cave scene with no flying creatures. You know, Nick's playing a dwarf fighter, and say one of his backgrounds is stonemason. And Mark is playing a paladin of the Crusader, and one of his backgrounds is, you know, siege engineer. Well, when you walk in, you have your bullet point that says, all right, so they're walking into a cave, looks like there are buildings around. Well, maybe you also had a little sub-bullet point that Nick's character, because of his background, realizes that these are ancient dwarven ruins, and Mark realizes this is where this giant battle happened and this area was pulled underground in an earthquake. So not only are you engaging the senses, becoming a little bit more descriptive, but you're giving freebies to two of your players for their descriptive backgrounds, and suddenly their players are more interested in the scene just because they have a little bit better of a tie.
Very good, yeah.
All right, how to build an encounter in 13th Age. So 13th Age uses encounter math, and speaking as somebody who has run 2nd, 3rd, and 4th edition D&D, I like 13th Age's encounter math the best of all. So 2nd edition had no encounter math. 3rd edition had bizarre calculus that you had to resolve where a challenge rating of equal level, blah, 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 it uses this much resources, and it took forever. 4th edition had it a little bit simpler, where you had an XP budget based off on how difficult you wanted the encounter to be versus level, but still, spending the XP budget took some time. So if you flip in your core rulebook to the combat math section on page 186 or page 203 in the monster system, or in the monster section, you can take a look at how to build encounters. It's very simple, but one thing you should note is that the math as presented in the book is designed to be heavily weighted in the player's favor. If you build an encounter baseline math that's presented, you will have an encounter that your players, barring bad rolls, should win. If you like to increase the risk, we saw a number of double and triple strength, I believe triple strength encounters mm-hmm. in Eyes of the Stone Thief. So you can push this math system pretty hard. Like, you can lean on this. These are general guidelines for a, I would say, slightly easy encounter.
And again, even if you don't want to spice it up and do a double strength or triple strength, you can always add a Nastier special or roll something maybe on the demon chart or something like that.
Yeah, add it in.
And just to give a couple of your monsters a little bit extra flavor, a little bit extra abilities, and make it just a little bit extra hard for your characters.
If you look at the math, there are three columns. Your goal is to come up with 1 point per player of basic math. So if you have four players, you want to come up with 4 points worth of monsters. At adventurer tier, one monster of the same level is equal to one PC. As you kind of shift into the higher levels, you get monsters of higher levels are worth one PC. And then there's some variance for how many mooks are worth one PC, and, you know, large monsters are worth more and huge monsters are worth more. But it really just comes down to shifting numbers around in the column mm-hmm. and building your encounter. It's pretty simple.
It's a lot easier than 3.5 or any of those where you had to kind of you know, first edition, you open open to the back, flip through T. Yeah, we're going to take something in the T column. Troll or, you know, troglodyte. So, yeah, there were no, you'd really had to, based on your experience and what you wanted to do. Yeah.
It was a lot more finesse on the GM side in earlier editions of D&D. Now, one thing we should kind of talk about right now is that encounters do not need to be balanced. There is a trend that encounters should be balanced and should always be fair. As a GM, I do not subscribe to that. I do not believe in the idea of concentric circles of difficulty radiating out from the starting point of your campaign. Remember, in 13th Age, you have the advantage as the GM of setting the realism of your world to where players can encounter things they can't possibly beat at this time, because players can always run away for free.
Mm-hmm. And I would throw it the other way, too. There's nothing wrong with having them stumbling upon, you know, at their champion level, and, you know, they run across, you know, the kobold nursery. It's going to be real easy. Let them run through it. Yeah. They won't get credit for an encounter towards their progression, but...
Well, that brings up an interesting point, both for encounter creation and just GMing in general. It is almost always better to build an encounter, in my opinion, where you have multiple creatures as opposed to one large creature.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah. Pathfinder. Worm God.
How many
by rounds? The time, not even one. It's playing in there if they did certain things. You know, and it takes him so many rounds to fully manifest at the very end of the game. They're high-level D&D PCs, and they just unleashed hell on him, and I didn't get to do one thing. And they took out the Worm God. This is super, because it, and that, again, I would warn you, don't look at it like, oh, it's huge, it's triple strength. No. If there's only one of them, they only get so many actions.
Yeah.
And if you've got, especially like six PCs, it's just like wham, 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 wham. And it gets very, that's where mooks come in.
Yeah. Also, battles that consist of nothing but mooks are also a lot of fun. Really kind of gives your players the feeling that they are the heroes of the story, where they're, you know, you just...
They can be, and they can be challenging, because sometimes you get a lot of, you know, you'll see when I do my encounter at the end.
Well, at an adventurer tier, 16 mooks is the equivalent of 4 PCs. That's just awesome.
And they could very easily lose that at adventurer level.
You know,
you're not that strong at first or second.
Our friend Luke is always trying to point out to players that mooks do good damage, they just die easy. So if you ignore the mooks, they're getting multiple attacks off on you. I have not tried this yet, so this is all just percolating in the back of my mind. But one thing that I did like from 4th edition for the solo monsters that they did, you roll initiative once for the monster. You add 10 to it and you subtract 10 from it. And so basically the monster goes 3 times around. You break up their abilities. At initiative plus 10, they do something. PCs go. At initiative, they do something, PCs go, and then kind of towards the end of the round, so that they feel like they're worthy of this kind of single monster attack. So, any other thoughts on building combat math? I very rarely use the math as written. 1.5 strength is kind of my default norm.
I would say don't forget that the monsters can flee too. You know, you don't have to slog out until you know, kill every single monster before you can move on. If the battle is obviously wrapping up and it's just a matter of rolling a couple more rounds, you could have the monsters flee and have that be impact the campaign later on, or just have them disappear in the background, just to save on time.
Yeah. Remember, this isn't like, you know, first, second, third edition D&D where you get experience per crit or killed.
Yeah.
It's the encounter that counts. So like you said, yeah, as long as you defeat them, talk to them, make them surrender.
Yeah, we surrender. Or even just, you know, set a timer with the escalation die. And if it looks like the PCs, you know, just have to mop up a couple of things, switch into a narrative mode, describe the wrap up, and move on.
Or let the players describe it.
Yeah.
Do a little montage.
Yeah. All right. So that's how the math works. But math isn't interesting. Knowing that you can take, you know, one monster per PC, that's very abstract. Let's get into some concrete stuff. So, Mark, how can a GM select adversaries for their encounter?
One way is by icon. Depending on the icons that the group follows, and there's probably more than one, you can take their enemies, you know, the opposites. If there's a crusader, oh, well, let's get the Diabolist and some of their followers type thing. So you can take opposites based on their icon.
13th Ages monsters all have shields or emblems that go with them to kind of help you identify which icon they are with. What I would really like, if you're listening, Pelgrane Press, what I would really like to see on your monster list on your website is being able to sort by icon. I don't believe we can do that yet.
Well, that's a great idea.
I know, right? So I could just say, hey, the bad guy of this adventure is the three. Sort by the three. Here are all the monsters that are linked with it. So icon selection is kind of story-based.
It's one story-based. I mean, and doesn't have to be, like I said, like Red Herring. You know, if you're doing the Crusader's Fist and you get Crusader, anti-Crusader icons, but then you're the follower of the Lich King, why not throw something to do with that? It has nothing to do with the main story, but you can pick something like that.
Well, and it really ties in if your players roll a five as well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the encounter is all about giving them the bonus from the five, but defeating the encounter is the consequence mm-hmm. of the five. Mm-hmm.
Another way is by out. One unique thing.
I was like, by out?
Hey, I'm just reading the notes.
That's
no. By one unique thing, and I really like that. I really, even before 13th Age, I tried to always make characters write up, what's your background? Mm-hmm. Why are you here? Where you come from? Might be short, might be several pages. Some players are better than others that really get into that. And try to present something that ties them in. And it does help, I think, when you have buy-in. Like you said, even when we talked about earlier, that little thing of, oh, yeah, you have Siegecraft. Well, you know that this was in the... And, yeah, and suddenly that player pays more attention.
Mm-hmm.
So using the one unique things helps a lot.
And I think if you can take each player and kind of align maybe at least one monster in every other encounter or something, you know, focus it on one player's one unique thing and kind of rotate around it. It'll help all of the players be a little bit more or feel a little bit more included in the play.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Definitely.
Well, that also ties into, you could tie them into backgrounds, like we just said.
Yes. Yeah. Get into their backgrounds and why, and, you know, your mother was, you know, a priestess for the priestess, and maybe you're not, but this is what happens. And yeah, we've done it in other games where backgrounds and siblings and parents and other such.
Well, and then if you have like in your case, Mark, where you had a bunch of stuff tying into like the Crusader, you could, I would throw in encounters that had the saved just because, you know, they kind of are thematically tied to the Paladin's background.
Mm-hmm.
And then don't forget in the environment too.
Right.
You know, if you're on a ship, you probably don't want to throw a rock golem at them because they just kick it off and it sinks. You know?
That's right. Or if you're in a cave, you do have a narrower band of monsters. Don't ever feel that the constraints of your environment are a negative thing. You have a lot to play with, and it just adds to, as Nick said, the verisimilitude of the environment. If you're dungeon delving, if you come up with a really cool idea for why this, you know, these tree creatures are in the dungeon, awesome, run with it. But don't be afraid to play two stereotypes as well. I mean, they give you a broad range of monsters. You're not going to be able to fit every monster in a campaign unless we do a 13th Age campaign called All the World's Monsters. And the goal is to just get every monster in there at least once.
And don't be afraid, too, to reskin your monsters. I know a lot of times as I was reading through the bestiary in the core book, there were some monsters that I really liked the mechanics of them, and that would be something that I might want to throw at a player, but the flavor just didn't seem right. You can always reskin them. Call them something else. Describe them somewhat differently and go ahead and use them.
Yeah, or make hybrids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
you did that with those flying, were they kobolds or goblins?
The flying kobolds that ended up being demons. Yeah, or, you know, just like with PCs, and we kind of talked about this in our last episode, switch out one power. Pull, if you really want your Duro to have the alchemist belts of the kobolds, you know, well, switch it out. You know, take away one of their normal abilities and give them something else. It really just blows the types of encounters you have wide open. So, Nick, you were talking about scenery and environment. Let's chat a little bit about that. What are some elements you can add beyond a square grid and just some monster tokens?
I think probably the most obvious one is adding traps. I really like the way that the authors of 13th Age described how not to overuse traps. They have a really good table on page 186 of the core book on how to use traps, and some good instructions and some guidance on how to use them, on whether or not the trap should be focused at one person versus the group, and how much damage should it deal. Again, the traps, they progress along with the adventurer, champion, epic tiers that you're playing at. And again, I think the traps need to be applicable to whatever environment that you're playing in. Yeah.
That table that Nick referenced on 186 is possibly the most important table just to have open to you. One of the things we haven't talked about in environments is that when you're setting up your encounter, you want to establish, is this an adventurer tier area? Is this a champion tier area? Is this an epic tier area? Once you set up kind of the zone, what type of tier it is, yeah, running that is super easy, because now you just say, okay, is it an average, a difficult, or a very difficult check? And you have your DCs. You don't need to plan DCs in advance. If the players do something and you're like, well, I think that, you know, the ceiling should collapse because of it, you've got all of your to hits, your damage. They boil it down very simply. And then I believe the page just previous kind of helps you plan out how many areas of that tier should be used per tier.
On 184?
Yeah, on page 184.
In addition to traps, also consider maybe tying the escalation die into the environment. You know, if you're playing on a ship that is sinking, you know, adding that escalation that once escalation die hits, you know, six, the ship's gone down and you got to find some way to get away. In Make It Your Own Luck, there was an escalation die based event that took place, and that kind of added to the overall theme of the setting and the environment, that it was in the middle of this epic battle that was taking place, and after a certain amount of time the Empire was coming in to rescue everyone. When you're planning your encounter, in addition to thinking through what sort of traps you want to use, what sort of descriptions you want to use, what monsters, also don't forget about the escalation die. Could you use it in some creative way?
Well, and I ran a chase scene using the escalation die, and I had the scene shifts happen when the escalation die reached certain numbers. So it was one long running encounter, but the monster shifted, the terrain shifted, and different effects happened based off the escalation die. It's a really great built-in trigger for your games. Something else that you could use the escalation die for is if you want to use that big solo monster, just give him an ability, and you don't want to deal with spreading his abilities out or anything like that. Give him an ability that goes off on a specific initiative roll based off the encounter die. So maybe the giant on initiative round two slams his fist into the wall and causes, I'm really into ceiling collapses today, causes stalactites to fall from the ceiling, doing an area of effect damage. It's something that he gets to do that's outside of his normal initiative round.
Mm-hmm.
Or he punts a character off of the balcony, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and going back to when you talk about their philosophy on the traps, and if you look at them, none of them are that deadly unless you just happen to be at the very end of out of heal-ups and everything else, and you're ready to die. And traps shouldn't be the end, though. I played in plenty of those in the previous editions of stuff that, yeah, every corner you turned around, there was going to be some sort of a deadly trap.
Or the
but I will say there is nothing as hilarious as having your halfling thief roll a one and fall into a trip, you know, pit trap and die. It's just hilarious.
Yeah,
I like that with hitting the wall and making, because it has that on that chart that we referenced on 186. It has the impromptu damage. So you're trying to figure, okay, if he hits the wall and stalactites fall, well, here's the impromptu damage: multiple targets, champion tier, 2d10 or 2d12. Done. It's not very hard.
Yeah.
But there's math in there, so tell your parents when you're trying to play, why are you playing a game? Because there's math in it, Mom.
That's right. I'm learning reading skills, interpretation skills, and math, and dragon killing skills.
That's right.
So the final thing that we talked about considering is the implications of the encounter. Ask yourself a couple of questions while you're building an encounter. You know, why is it important to the story? And then I usually find it's helpful to just make a little bullet point. What happens if the PCs win? What happens if they lose or flee? And, you know, what are some other options that they could possibly do? Can they use the terrain to trap the monster as opposed to beating it? Can they talk to the monster as opposed to not? A good guideline to have is never have your campaign hinge on the players successfully completing an encounter. If the only way for them to get the clue to go to the next place is to kill X monster, there's a chance they don't kill X monster, and then your campaign stalls. always have other options, always have ways to don't build yourself into that corner.
Yeah, because this is about encounters as you're going through. Totally different. We might have to do an episode on boss fights, but you know, the end fight, because if they die or they don't succeed, that is the end of that campaign, and that's totally different.
I think it's fair to ask yourself, what's the worst possible thing that the players could do?
Lick a wall.
Yeah, that's another one of those things that I'm never going to live down.
Nope.
If you think through it a little bit in advance, you probably won't be as surprised when the players do something really crazy in the moment.
The other thing is with planning encounters, at least for me, don't overplan encounters. Plan just what you need to run it. Maybe some notes on the monsters, and we'll kind of get into that in the next section. But the other thing that you can always do with an encounter is shelve it. If you put in some time planning and the players avoid the encounter, keep those notes, because with a simple reskin, they can be useful later in the campaign.
And then they probably won't remember it either.
Right.
The more effort you put into an encounter and detail it, either they'll skip it or it'll be short.
Yeah.
The ones that you just like, okay, so they run into some drow merchants and a priestess. It turns out that's the one that you almost kill the party, and it's the most memorable.
Yeah.
Versus the detailed one at like, and they skip it, or it goes bad for the GM-wise, and it's an easy encounter, and they don't remember it, whatever, and it had nothing. You thought it was the best encounter ever, so.
Yeah. Yeah, plan to what you need. If you're good at improv but bad at monster statistics, spend your time making notes on that. If you are great at remembering that the dragon breathes every other round for this amount of damage, don't make notes on that. Make notes on
the condition of the cave.
Yeah.
And why is there a fish in the corner?
Use your notes to strengthen, to shore up your weak areas as a GM. Things that you're not as good at is where you want to spend most of your time prepping. But let it never be said that we just talk on Iconic. We have each prepared a sample encounter for you to kind of give you some ideas about encounter creation. Man,
our platitudes.
Our platitudes. So each of us has prepared an encounter that we will post on the website. And we're just going to share those with you now. Nick made an adventure tier encounter. Mark did the champion tier, and I did the
epic
tier. All right, Nick, what did you come up with for your adventure tier encounter?
Well, I was thinking, I had caves on my mind. Any underground kind of moist environment is what I was picturing in my head for level 2 players. A couple of ideas why the characters might get in there. Maybe you need to collect something for a ritual. Maybe the creature that's hiding down there has stolen something, maybe a dragon egg or something like that. Maybe the monster killed and ate a courier and the messenger bag is discarded somewhere, but you have to go in there and find it. Or maybe that those that are guarding the cave, someone has put them in a guard. So the first thing that I had was set a DC 15 to notice a trap. On a failure, the Trog Chanter ambushes the players, gets a free attack before the initiative gets rolled. On a failure, the Trog Chanter is exposed and initiative is rolled at that point. I statted out, I stuck pretty closely to the table on page 186, so I didn't really overpower it. So based on our conversation, it's probably going to be an easier fight. But based on how many players you have, I statted out how many Trog Chanters, how many aerial spores, and how many sporiers to put in there. I liked the Trog racial ability that it has a negative penalty for different humanoid races just because they stink so bad. I enjoyed that. And then kind of playing off between that and the fungaloids, in the bestiary it talks about not many creatures will work with the fungaloids, but made an exception to the troglodytes because the stench doesn't bother the fungaloids. So thought it fit well together. And so it was an interesting exercise for me because I've never built an encounter before. So for me to be able to go back and have that chart handy and know, okay, I'm going to do the math here. This is how much these monsters are worth, and studying everything else out there. I felt like I had a lot of assets in it. I felt like I had a lot of assets helping me in this process. So.
Cool. Now, don't take the math too far, players who are listening, because if you have 4 PCs and you encounter 4 critters, you can do the math and go, oh, well, they're this because there's only 4. Because if you have a GM like JM, they'll be stronger. There'll still be four of them, but they're going to be stronger because it's going to be tough. So don't just think, oh, well, there's four. Or, oh, look, there's 10 of them. They must be MOOCs. Sometimes you have to find out which one's the MOOC because they all look the same. Yeah. There might be seven MOOCs with bows that you didn't know are MOOCs, and they're critting you because there's seven of them together, and that's their special ability. That made that fight a lot tougher as Stone Thief.
Yeah. Well, and don't underestimate the fact that with large numbers, the GM can also be throwing just lower-level creatures against you that you still have to slog through.
Yeah, they're not always MOOCs. They have to be a MOOC, air quote. If they're a low-level trooper or wrecker, they don't have the MOOC rule.
Yeah.
They have to be a MOOC.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sometimes just having a group of, overall we call them minions, doesn't mean they're MOOCs. And they won't die. Oh, well, I do 50 points. I should kill. No, when you killed one. What do you mean? He's not a MOOC.
Nick, that's a great encounter. Any thoughts or feedback, Mark?
No, I like it. I like the Fungaloids. Yeah. I ran that in DCC, and they were actually cooperative. They don't attack you. You can buy healing mushrooms.
Great encounter.
That was good, yeah.
Thanks. So Mark had the champion encounter, and what do you got for us, Mark?
Okay, my random encounter I was using, and you've heard earlier, the red herring thing has no direct connection. It can be if you want, if you're into devils, if you listen to our previous podcast on devils. Because I love it when they get sidetracked, and you throw in, why are there devils? Are they, you know, and then they're trying to figure out how they're interlocked into the story, and you can tell if they don't care, then maybe you've lost your players. If they've never fought devils, it has nothing to do with the story, and they're like, whatever, it's just another encounter. I get more experience next, and you might want to take a look. And it might be your group too. Maybe they don't care. I played in groups like that. They don't really care about the story. They want to kill stuff, get treasure, move on. So anyway, in this one, I call it a random encounter. The PCs have something. Wanted or needed by a very powerful master. In this case, is a Pit Fiend. Now, Pit Fiend's just not going to come and take it. So what he does is he's going to use a Fury Devil or an Irony. That's on page 175 of 13 True Ways. If you don't have it, go get it. Great stuff in there.
Yeah.
And instead of, like we talked about, having just the one, because the Irony is an 8th level wrecker. Okay, so it's higher level. Well, one of them's all good. So what are they going to do? She, because they're female, are going to bring a mob of Lemures.
Nice.
They're a third level mook. Not very tough, but the description, these devils are mindless masses that infest the pit. They mob you. Well, they have a lot of great special abilities devils do. They can squirm, so they can get into anywhere they want. The living wave, if three or more lemurs engage an enemy, they can pick it up and move it along with them as they please without taking opportunity attacks. So you can separate the group with this living wave of flesh.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Nobody home. They get to move around. They resist fire. And I would include in this one the nastier specials, Too Dumb to Die. At the start of the lemur's mob's turn, roll a d6 for each lemur in the mob that's dropped this battle. For each six, one of them reassembles its horde self and stumbles back into the melee. Now, the players can fix this by adding seven additional dice, because remember, these guys only have 13 hit points. So for every 13, you get to take out one. But if you spend seven more, they're out of the fight completely. And it might take them a while to figure out, why aren't these things dying? You might just think more are appearing on the battlefield where you know they're regenerating.
Yeah, good background
reassembling.
Check.
So they're great. Love them. So you've got these, and then the Fury Devil, the Irines. So the Irines is sent to punish the mortal, because, you know, the hubris of you possessing the item that I want.
Yeah.
Punish the mortal, retrieve the item. So they bring it. Now, using counter math, mooks are 0.2, so you bring plenty. And again, you have to tailor it to the size and composition of your group. Maybe if it's fighter heavy, maybe not fighter heavy. You know, your bard, you know, a lot of the different player characters' classes are very useful, but, you know, if you've got a mage, a cleric, and two bards, you might want to not bring 50 mooks along for that fight. So, and it happens. Now, Irines are on page 175, sorry. Lemur's the first one. So if you go down to the Irines, I just want to touch on a couple of things. One of them is Hellbent. One Fury shows up, you take her out. Three more rise up to finish the job. And oh, by the way, JM, since your paladin killed the first Fury, you're now on the list too, so you need to be punished. When you take out those three, five rise up. Now, it says when those five are done, you're safe, maybe. Maybe then next time, farther down at epic level, maybe Bearded Devil show or something else shows up for
or
this
the pit
item.
Fiend, yeah.
Or eventually the Pit Fiend. So, and again, I put this more of an outdoor random. Can you talk your way out of this? Maybe. But remember, you still have to be punished. So, and that opens up some things if you're a good GM. You know, if a fight's going bad, you might tell them, all right, if you surrender and give me, you know,
X, Y, or Z,
the Red Crown of Omadon that you've got in your pack, I'll let you go. But this has to happen to you.
Yeah, it's a good way to build in a campaign loss. What happens if your players?
Yeah, and they well, and now is that a flee or is that, you know, maybe a wash? We won't give them a failure because I've got you on the hook for later because he's always making a deal with the devil. Yeah.
I like how you turn that on its head. Normally, the characters are going and getting something. In this case, the monsters are coming to get something. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, and it should be something because by that time, you know, those are mid levels, and that's another. This is another good way to knock them back down because by the time you're that sixth level character, you're starting to get more powers and you think you're tough, and then you get knocked down.
Yeah,
hard. And they should have some sort of a magic item. Maybe they don't even realize it's a magic item. And again, if you tie it into their background or one unique thing.
Well, and it could spawn off a whole other side quest if the devils do make off with this item and you decide, no, we need that. Well, now, in addition to your main story, you now have this side story of recovering this item from...
Well, especially if it's... Maybe it's involved in your storyline and your icon gave it to you to help somewhere in the future. And you haven't really used it yet. And maybe it doesn't seem great for you. Maybe you just haven't unlocked everything. Devils have it. Now you can contact it. Hey, what do you mean you lost my slipper? Do you realize how special that was?
Or maybe use it as a five.
Yeah.
You know, you get someone who runs up and pushes a magic item in your hands and says, here, you need to deliver this. Or, you know, this is on behalf of the priestess or something. Oh. And he conveniently fails to mention that there are devils after him.
Or the devil's in disguise, and she has been bound to give this item to you. But as soon as you accept it, then she's like, well, unfortunately, that concludes my deal. Now I want that item back.
Oh, and there's plenty, if you read through, there's plenty of devils that do that stuff. Yeah. You know, the honey devil and some of the other ones that can insinuate into things. That was mine.
Cool.
And it ratchets up, so hopefully they can get through it. Five fury devils are pretty tough.
Yeah. No joke.
All right, so let's go epic.
All right, so I made this the volcanic lair of the flame wreath dragon. I was going to actually do a one with a white dragon and go all undead, but I wanted something a little bit more classic. So there may be an undead with a white dragon coming eventually. Basically, you can drop this encounter anywhere where you need to give the players a MacGuffin. Dragon has an item in a hoard. Some previous aged archmage used this volcano as a dumping place for items that were too dangerous to be used and too potent to be destroyed. Or even if you just want to give your players, maybe they need a wish from an Efreet to get through the next thing. This encounter is built around dragons, Efreets, and elementals. The lair is in an active volcano. I have the mountain spirit of the volcano kind of sleeping. The idea is that there is a violent fire elemental at the heart of this mountain who's barely being kept asleep by the dragon's deeds. The dragon likes living here because it's a volcano but doesn't want this fire spirit awake. And you'll see when we post these that it's got your players have abilities to either have the options to either anger, soothe, or control the mountain spirit for different effects. They can either increase the escalation die, which has negative effects to them as well. They can decrease the escalation die, which keeps the volcano stable, doesn't give them the bonus for the escalation die, or they can actually try and get the spirit to lash out at their enemies. I'm using both nastier specials for the Flame Wreath Dragon. It is so hot in this volcano that fire resistance counts for nothing. When the dragon breathes fire on you, even if you're fire resistant, you've got no defense against it. And every round, it's summoning new minions from the flames. So new...
Even if it's in my background, it's one unique thing. I'm immune to fire.
Yeah. Yeah, not this fire drake. Fire drake's fire. And then I made a little escalation chart. So basically, as the fight is going, I put in little reminders for me, you know, check for wildfire, check for smoke minions, something that happens every round. So the monsters that are used in this encounter are obviously a flame wreath dragon, a couple of ifrits, and then some fire elementals. And so the fire elementals start off tough, And every round you check to see if they basically go into their wildfire mode, and then they stay in that mode for the rest of the fight. And the wildfire mode is very nice. So then, and then the volcano, as the mountain spirit starts waking up, it starts actively erupting till the point when the escalation die hits 6, the entire cavern fills with a fountain of lava. So try and solve this by escalation die 6 or you're in trouble. The other things I put down to remember is I built this encounter to kind of really play up the idea of wildfire. So there are whipping flames from the fire elementals. If they hit, the fire also jumps to another person and does damage. So if they hit one person, they're hitting at least two. And the Blades of the Perfect Warrior, they hit one person, they're hitting at least two. No defense on the second one. If I hit Nick, Mark takes extra fire damage. I also have the PCs, if they roll an odd, hitting the fire elementals, they take fire damage. There's lots of ongoing damage, and the dragon has fear. So if as soon as they drop below 120 hit points, they don't get to use the escalation die, and the dragon does. So I think it's a pretty cool encounter.
Yeah, it's a piece of cake.
Yeah.
Sounds epic.
Oh, it's so bad. The puns. All right.
I see a lot of death in this one. Just the ongoing damage would kill a lot.
GMs be warned, like Gareth, I take no responsibility for you actually using this encounter in your game. However, if you do use any of these three encounters, please put comments on either our Google Plus community or on our website and take a look at them. Give us some feedback. Tell us what you think of the adventures, how they tie in with what we talked about in the episode.
Yeah, what happened with your group? You'd be interested.
Yeah. If they all died from fire, well, then we, you know, kind of know. Well, we are pleased to announce our second contest for the Iconic Podcast. We're calling it Get Out and Run 13th Age.
How original.
How original. After doing our organized play episode, Mark, Nick, and I were chatting, and we wanted to do something to get organized play up and running at your local game store, and what better way to do that than with our listeners. Nick, why don't you tell us about the contest?
All right. What we are wanting you to do is to go to your friendly local gaming store and run one of the organized play adventures. And then tell us about it. We will need to know your name, the name of your gaming store, when you ran it, what adventure, and what parts of that adventure, and then a maximum of 300-word write-up of what happened. And it would be great also if we could get a picture of your group so we can see what your table looks like.
We'll post all of the entries on the website. Winners will be determined randomly. But each session that you run will count as a separate entry. I mean, you'll have to put a separate entry together, but you can enter multiple times, but you can only win once. And what kind of contest would it be without prizes? Mark, tell us about our prizes.
Okay, we were graciously allowed to offer the first place winner $20 used on Pelgrane's Press website. Second gets 15, and third gets 10. Remember, you can only win once, but the more you enter, the greater chance to win that first prize.
That's right. So when you're ready to submit your entry, jump over to iconicpodcast.com. There will be a post that has a link to a Google form that will just allow you to fill out all of that and submit it. In fact, that is the official way to submit entries for this contest. All other ways will be looked at and then promptly discarded. This contest will run between now and March 31st. We're giving you just over 2 full months to get into your game store, get a group going. Winners will be announced by April 6th. Get out there and game. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.